You know the Keir Starmer video with the Dire Straits?
Yes.
And the F-35 jets?
Yes. Yeah.
That's been deleted from his TikTok.
Has it?
I was trying to pull it up and it's not there anymore.
Oh, wow.
Felt cute. Might delete later.
The essence of very much.
Our number one priority is protecting our people.
I think that shows there's some awareness that whatever Keir Starmer's TikTok account is doing, it's not working in some ways.
Yes, so with everything that's been happening with Iran and the United States and Israel and the United Kingdom, Keir Starmer's been posting on TikTok and his content has been popping off in a way that it doesn't usually. But what is quite hard to tell is how much it's popping off because the content is performing well and people like it, or how much it's popping off because people are finding it a bit cringe and are sort of taking the mick.
Some people think they're intentionally being cringe, but I think in this episode we should talk about why TikTok works for some politicians, like why it works for Mamdani, why it works for Zach Polanski,
Donald Trump,
and why it doesn't
work
as well for people like Keir Starmer.
So we're going to chat about that. We're also today going to chat about this case involving, the disappearance of Nancy Guthrie. You might have heard about it. She's the mum of a very famous presenter, journalist in the US, and it has triggered a whole wave of social media content, particularly from what we often refer to as sleuths, people turning up at the scene.
I love the way you said sleuths.
Sleuths. Or sitting on their sofas and posting content. What does this frenzy mean? We are going to unpick it and figure out whether it's helpful or unhelpful.
You're a bit of an internet sleuth yourself.
I'm an internet sleuth about internet sleuths.
Yeah, but this isn't the first sleuth story by any means. If there's a history of sleuths.
Loads,
so we should get into that.
We'll get into that as well, exactly. The history of the sleuths.
So who is Nancy Guthrie? What's going on with that story?
So Nancy Guthrie is the mum of a really famous television presenter, journalist, Savannah Guthrie, in the US. She presents NBC's Today. She's on primetime telly in the United States, which is, well, one of the reasons why this case has got so much attention. And she's been trying to rally some of that attention too, understandably, because her mum has now been missing for over a month. She's elderly. She has health problems. And what the evidence suggests is that she was abducted in the middle of the night from her home. At first, she wears a pacemaker and they thought they might be able to track her for a period of time, but then that wasn't possible. And one of the reasons why this has been popping up all over the place on social media is because there's been some really quite scary viral footage that's been shared. This Ring doorbell camera footage was released and it shows someone in a balaclava. It's like really terrifying, going up to the door. And the family had said that, you know, they'd pay huge amounts of money for information or for her return. And it was suggested that they were demanding a ransom, the people that had taken Nancy Guthrie. But there really hasn't been, at least outwardly, that much progress in terms of what's gone on here.
So at the heart of this, there's incredibly tragic story of a family who've lost their elderly mother who has a pacemaker, and they're probably terrified. But as far as the internet's concerned, this has all the hallmarks of a true crime story. It's a celebrity's family member. It's a mystery. We don't know where they've gone. It seems like a neo-noir or like a kind of Fargo type story. So how has the internet been interpreting this?
Yeah, so particularly disappearances, I would say, and particularly disappearances that become high profile, whether it's because there's a huge amount of kind of publicity around them or because it relates to someone who's well known. They certainly, as of late, have frequently inspired these frenzies on social media where everyone's looking for answers. And it's kind of human nature, right? Like, you're curious as to what's gone on here. You've got some clues that you can start to piece together, but you don't really know what's happened. You've also got the police dealing with the case, the FBI getting involved as well. And, you know, there's been some criticism over the way that they've handled this. There were suggestions that the crime scene wasn't secured properly, or that, like, that there have been different points where they haven't necessarily been as transparent or as clear as they could have been. They have generally defended their approach to this case. But when you've got that vacuum of information, it's the perfect place for the sleuths or the kind of social media influencers who like posting about true crime to get involved, get stuck in, and to try and essentially kind of participate in what ends up feeling a little bit like a game, I would say. And when it comes to this case, I mean, there are some influencers who are just posting like updates, information. They're just reading what's coming out of from the authorities or from the family or what have you. But then there are others who are posting stuff that is actively misleading or disinformation. So, for example, the sheriff has cleared the family members as suspects, but nonetheless, there continues to be a huge amount of speculation that members of Nancy Guthrie's family are somehow behind this or linked to it, in spite of what the authorities have said. And then a bandmate of Nancy Guthrie's son-in-law was wrongly named as a person of interest, and that meant that his home got like mobbed, essentially, because the influencers we're talking about here, some of them are actually turning up like they're kind of investigators and just filming content like close to the crime scene, essentially.
Yeah, I've seen people on TikTok posing outside the house where this horrible thing happened. So have you spoken to any of these influencers? Why are they doing it?
The most extreme influencers, like the people who are actually turning up at homes or posting the most egregious disinformation, don't tend to want to chat to you. The people that I've chatted to are what I would consider in that kind of like middle bucket of like they're posting quite a lot of content, often like factually accurate, sometimes going down certain routes and rabbit holes. But what's hard in cases like this are we actually don't have the answers about what's happened broadly. Like we don't know where Nancy Guthrie is or who's taken her right now. So it's hard to kind of outright rule out some of what's being said. The more extreme conspiracy theories we'll get to in a minute. But one of the influencers who I spoke to is this woman called Lindsay Rust Purper. And essentially she kind of aggregates information about the case from her apartment in New York.
I'm back on the case of Nancy Guthrie, and we had a great live tonight. We actually spoke to one of Nancy's neighbors, and she gave us an update that we haven't been hearing from others.
I asked her quite a lot about why she's doing this, like what is the motivator? And she said that for most of the sleuths and the other people in this ecosystem online, it's about trying to actually solve the case.
Obviously, there are online sleuths that are, their purpose is to, solve this case. But for me, I think mine is more just like aggregated recaps that I was finding all over the internet. And then people started coming to me with, exclusive information. I do think that the people on social media could solve the case. And it's not just my opinion that the organization of this investigation has been poor. And, I think that the FBI and Sheriff's Department could be caught up in an old way of thinking. And I think that there's a lot of people on the internet that are trying to solve this and not for the reward. I think because they are genuinely, they have the means to do it.
However rare, there are some examples where internet sleuths have kind of found out something about a crime.
Yeah, like Gabby Petito. Gabby Petito was killed by her boyfriend at the time. They were traveling, but they'd obviously like posted quite a lot of content on social media, and as a consequence it meant that like people essentially figured out like where she'd been killed and where her body was and all of this stuff, and that was a real sort of, I don't know if boost is the right word, but it really turbocharged this social media community, because it was an example of where like, oh, actually we've managed to figure some things out using effectively like open source techniques where you're looking at content before the authorities did. And therefore let's keep doing it because we might get to the bottom of it.
Yeah. And the OG example of that is Don't Fuck With Cats, which obviously kind of idolized the internet sleuth.
And they were trying to find that guy who was like killing cats, essentially.
Exactly. And they did, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But those cases are very rare. And I think the majority of internet sleuth cases end up being problematic and misled. And we can get into why. But a good example of that is the Boston Marathon bombing, where the Reddit forum that is devoted to this kind of internet sleuthing, which has, over a million subscribers, it's a huge part of the internet, started basically pointing out people in the crowd. And it became kind of like a racist Where's Waldo, or Where's Wally, as you call it here.
There you go.
Because it was like any kind of non-white person in the crowd pictured, some of them who were identified by Reddit, and then they were sent threatening messages. People showed up outside their homes. So,
and this is one of the huge risks of this kind of social media sleuthing, which is when people are putting out information that is not verified just based on like, oh, I've spotted this or I've seen this, and then it ends up being a problem. And I asked Lindsay a bit about how she verifies what she's posting.
I've been really, really careful about sharing anything more than what I've heard, directly from a neighbor or that we have confirmed, whether it's through, the FBI or the Pima County Sheriff's Department. I really haven't done much of sharing any theories that I have, I'm getting stuff from about psychics or mediums talking about where she is. I'm getting the craziest videos all day long. And I really don't share anything that is not directly from those sources I previously mentioned.
So one of the sources, for example, that she does use is like she'll look at kind of like flight trackers and radars and that sort of thing and flight logs. And she talks about like seeing that a flight had landed at a particular time around the vicinity area where Nancy Guthrie lives, and then it had gone to Mexico, and therefore was Nancy Guthrie in Mexico? And she'd sent that tip off into the FBI, into the authorities. And it's really hard to say, well, hang on, that's misinformation or wrong, because ultimately right now we don't know where she is. So like, it's almost like the kind of subversion of open source techniques, which are broadly valuable things. Like people can look at all sorts of publicly available information to piece together stories. But the issue here is that you've got people who are just kind of like deciding perhaps to have a crack at it. And actually, like when I've investigated other cases, people might remember there was a woman called Nicola Bully who went missing. She died in Lancashire in the UK. And there was this huge frenzy on social media and all kinds of like really extreme conspiracy theories. And then also the Idaho murders that happened in the US, these students who got killed in their student house, which was again terrible and just inspired so much misinformation. And I really pushed Lindsay on what happens when, you know, actually the people posting on social media misidentify someone and can effectively like ruin their life, tarnish their reputation.
People with really, really big followings are being not as careful about, you know, throwing out the names or their theories of who they think is involved. And that to me is where, you know, I don't want to get involved on that level. And I agree, it's wasting time. And to me, it what I'm frustrated with is the sheriff or FBI have asked the public to help in finding, you know, the perpetrator, or the abductor, and they're not giving us some of the important information that we need. And so it is leaving people kind of scrambling and, you know, placing blame in places they shouldn't.
So who else have you spoken to?
So another person I spoke to is this guy called Jordan Rohn.
My entry into the Nancy Guthrie investigation has come by way of me being a former criminal prosecutor here in Pennsylvania and working on cases with some of the best detectives in the country and taking cases to trial and having evidence in front of me and analyzing that and really putting the puzzle together.
He posts on TikTok as well, like he's got his mic out, he's analyzing stuff, often basing it on, you know, legitimate things like Google Trends, for example. So he'll use like open source information to piece things together. The issue is that some of his videos are accurate and analytical. Others really dip into the kind of conspiratorial and more. And I asked him a little bit about, you know, how he ensures that he's not posting things that are inaccurate.
In the world of investigations, of course, there are going to be different leads or theories that turn out to be inaccurate. And I mean, quite frankly, the fact that this case hasn't been solved yet leads me to say confidently that, you know, so far all the theories are disproven until they are, one of them is proven right. Before any videos go out, before I even film any videos, the information's already been turned over to the FBI. And that gives them the opportunity, I think, to go through the lead, to investigate it on their own. And for instance, I've sent over actual geographic locations that I think that they should search. And I give them the opportunity to go and search that location without having any public interference or people who follow me on TikTok going and disrupting the scene.
But I did also challenge him on, for example, there's this one video he posted where he talks about how because Savannah Guthrie, Nancy Guthrie's daughter, had done an interview with some of Jeffrey Epstein's victims, that somehow this could be connected to Jeffrey Epstein or the former Prince Andrew.
$1 million reward is offered. Crickets. Savannah offers to pay the ransom. We get no proof of life. Why is that? Because whoever's behind this already got paid by the person who ordered the hit. And it wasn't pocket change. We're talking millions from a very wealthy person or entity with deep pockets.
And I really pushed him on this because, you know, it feels like adding together one and one and getting three. And ultimately his perspective is, well, I can just put the information out there and people can make up their own minds.
Law enforcement obviously decides what is actionable and what's not. But I think, you know, silence doesn't help anyone. So we do know that, for instance, with Jeffrey Epstein, actually it was the FBI themselves that released the information, who said that he had bank accounts set up in Grand Junction, Colorado, which happens to be the location that I found five different search spikes taking place prior to Nancy's abduction. searching for her address. So I think it's really a responsibility on my part to put information that I find out into the public square and let people analyze and dissect it as they see fit.
To be clear, both of the influencers that I chatted to seem to have, you know, like genuine intentions. They're not people posting like the most extreme disinformation, and they're certainly not the people turning up at the home or invading anyone's privacy, anything like that. Those are the more extreme influencers, but ultimately they all exist as part of this kind of social media sleuth world.
The sleuthing stuff is kind of a microcosm for everything that's wrong with the internet. This impulse to see it as a kind of mystery, as a true crime mystery to solve with clues everywhere, is the same kind of impulse that's led people to come up with QAnon, to, you know, Pizzagate, anti-vax theories.
It's so participatory, isn't it?
Yeah, but the idea that like police work is participatory is ludicrous. Like, leave it to the police.
But then I guess, and this is what's difficult about these cases, particularly disappearances, is there's often a real willingness from, understandably, from the family to like publicize this, to get people engaged with it. The downside of that is that everyone gets kind of too engaged, and then you have like false accusations, and then you have people sometimes forgetting at times, not the people I chatted to, but I'd say the wider influencer network, forgetting that this is real people. Like, there is a real woman who is currently missing and a family that's hugely affected by that.
Yeah, absolutely. But what is it about social media that makes people thrust themselves into this like neo-noir detective?
Yeah. Well, I'd say there's two things. It's like the great sort of leveling that social media has contributed to, which is everyone can take part, sitting on your settee, whatever, out and about. You have a mobile phone, you can film content, you can make stuff. And not just that you can make stuff, but point two, that stuff is rewarded. You get views, you get likes, you get engagement. And speaking to both Lindsay and Jordan, they kept reiterating, like, for me, this isn't about the views. For me, this isn't about the likes. But then, like, there was a bit where Jordan was like, you know, it's not just about that. And like, ultimately, you do get a reward in so much as whether it's just the feeling of people viewing and engaging with and liking your content and it's a topic you find interesting, or whether in some cases, and I've met quite a few kind of social media sleuths who've actually been able to monetize their content, like they've basically turned it into a job. They've been able to use the monetization schemes on the different platforms and get money. It's like the company's business models and just like algorithmic models incentivize this kind of behavior. And actually, the more extreme and the more outrageous and the you know, if you can come up with a new hot take, you're going to get more engagement.
Have you heard of the Texas sharpshooter fallacy?
Yeah.
Where like a guy shoots a blank page a bunch of times, then draws the bullseye around it. That's what people are doing. They're basically seeing clusters of unrelated incidents and questions and arranging them into a neat theory.
There's been some really interesting research that's been done about the brains of people that believe conspiracy theories or the kind of attributes that they possess. There's two really like key indicators. One is like rigidity of thought, so like the inability to adapt what you believe or think based on the evidence in front of you. The other thing is all about like pattern recognition. Like, it's basically like spotting patterns where they actually don't exist. The last thing I'd say about these kinds of sleuths and influencers is that they're often like really like nice, normal, like, I mean, like they've got kind of quirky hobbies, I guess, but like nice, normal, interesting people. And that is the other issue here, which is I think that social media like desensitizes you to the impact of this content, particularly when it can be negative and defamatory or cause harm. If we post a video and like loads of other people who are interested in this content are like watching it, engaging with it, commenting on it, obviously we think that's normal. Like, it's like it distorts your kind of like perception of what is socially acceptable.
Yeah, at the top of this episode, we were speaking about this Keir Starmer video, why TikTok works for some people, not for Keir Starmer. So I actually spoke to some insiders and people who led the digital strategy campaigns for some of the biggest kind of elections in Western democracies in the past 10 years. And one of the things that people said was that authenticity on TikTok is really important. So they tried this with Rishi Sunak. They tried to have him in front of a bunch of F-35 fighter jets, making him out to be kind of James Bond. It didn't work. It came across as cringe because he's not that person. And so then they shifted the strategy to kind of having him in front of a whiteboard, being a bit geeky.
Yeah, and I guess at the heart of that is when the person and the type of content like match or don't match up with each other.
Yeah, and the kind of digital political consultants I spoke to said that with Keir Starmer, he should just be presented as a kind of studious, lawyerly person or talking about football because of the two areas where he can be genuine. So there's this question, right? Why does it work for Trump? Why does it work for Mamdani? Why does it work for Farage and Polanski, but not for Keir Starmer? And I spoke to Sean Topham from the firm Topham Guerin, and they're the guys who, they kind of did the first political shit post, which was for Boris Johnson's campaign when they put "Get Brexit Done," his slogan, in Comic Sans, which they did because they knew it would piss people off.
That felt like peak Twitter era as well. Like, I remember everyone reacting to that.
Exactly. So I asked them about this, and they're clearly very proud of this because it set the internet on fire. They quite cleverly got their message out of Boris Johnson wants to get Brexit done in as wide a way as possible, kind of by rage baiting people. Now, I asked him about the Keir Starmer stuff as, you know, is this a rage bait? Is he doing cringe stuff on purpose? And he said that the ultimate effect of this, if people see him as cringe, if they don't see him as authentic, in the way that it kind of does work with Boris Johnson, does work with Trump, is that it actually makes people like him less.
You know, if they're sharing it because it's cringe, it can have a real adverse impact on the communicator as someone who's actually out of touch, as someone who's a tourist in the internet rather than, you know, a participant. And so there is a real important authenticity test that, you know, politicians need to ask themselves before they go into these spaces. Because if you do it with sort of wit and confidence, you know, you can kind of survive any of the hostility or rage. But if there's any trepidation or it feels inauthentic to that communicator, it can really come back to bite you. And I worry, you know, for Keir in trying to lean into this space, it feels fundamentally jarring when we see him trying to be this sort of commander-in-chief type, because I don't feel he's proposed himself in that way. So it can feel inconsistent with what we think we know about him.
And you can try and predict how social media users are going to respond and everyone's going to respond, but you can't always tell what's going to stick and what's going to fly. And like, if we think of like recent elections where social media campaigns have been very effective, so take like Zoran Mamdani, who is now the mayor of New York. His campaign was so effective because for people who like him, it made him more likable. It was like, oh, this guy's like us, he's genuine, he's authentic, he cares about these issues. Like, he was turning up on like nights out and people were filming him. He was doing like these videos that felt like in line with trends that were happening on TikTok, but not in that way that Kamala Harris did, which was sort of like, remember Brat Summer and everything else, that felt like a little bit like just a little bit too late. Like, yeah. You'd be like, oh, that's kind of like when your mum finds a meme.
Exactly.
Or your dad finds a meme and they think it's funny. Whereas it felt legitimate. And the same could be said of Zach Polanski, the Green Party leader as well, who recently got chosen to be the leader of that party. It feels like he gets it and like he gets how it works. Like, does Starmer really know what's going on with these montages? Like, is he the mastermind behind them? Like, I imagine not. Maybe he is. But with the others, it feels like they could be, even when they're not.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And with Mamdani and Polanski, if you have a simple message that's in opposition to something, that does well in a short video, therefore it does well on TikTok. When you're like a sitting Labour prime minister, it's very hard to think like, what is your TikTok life going to be, right?
Because you're not really like opposing, like, yeah. It's not like you've not got the same goal, I guess. And that's the thing as well, like during an election campaign, it's like the goal of a lot of this content is to both energise your base and to reach like undecided people who might not have heard of you. Like, ideally what you want is to pop up at the top of people's social media feeds and then they'll think, oh, I hadn't heard of this person before, but now I'm kind of interested in their stuff. Actually, in a weird way, if we look at Keir Starmer's content and the reaction to it, if it's not ironically cringe, which like it could be, but nonetheless, it feels like a lot of people aren't responding to it like it's ironically cringe, then ultimately it feels like they'd almost be better to not post anything at all than to post things that users are saying, well, that's kind of weird, if they want to be popular, quote unquote.
Yeah. And what people I've spoken to have said is that now that you can't really target political advertisements in the same way you used to on social media, because everyone's on TikTok, all you can really do is grow your following so that when the election comes, you've got a big following to then target with content. But also, you no longer need to have a viral account to make a viral piece of content.
Yeah.
And so they're always trying, what's the video? What's the meme that's going to make, that we're going to get, that's going to go viral, that's going to secretly get our message across, which is about how amazing the prime minister is?
You know, 10 years ago, you definitely wanted to have 1 million followers, 100,000 followers. That was a great benchmark test. But you could have 2,000 followers now and reach, you know, 5-10 million people with, you know, very good content.
And the thing is, Sean told me that you're not just competing with other politicians. You're competing with the entire internet for the attention span of mainly young people, but increasingly everyone's brains.
We always say in political advertising, it's so easy to get focused on what's the Labour Party doing, what's the Conservative Party doing, in this case, what's Reform doing, or Lib Dems and the Greens. But actually, you're not just competing against those mouthpieces. You're competing against every brand that's advertising. Coca-Cola, John Lewis, McDonald's, they are all taking up eyeballs and oxygen in the news feed, in every sort of touch point where advertising can reach. So your message needs to be consistent, clear. It has to have value to someone. Audiences are increasingly dismissive if they feel like they're being spun to. So if it feels like you're sloganeering to them, that ain't gonna fly.
I think it's so important that we talk about the way that the social media companies are ultimately like influencing politics here, because this becomes about gaming the algorithms, the recommendation systems, because like you say, the kind of targeted ads thing feels like the thing of the past. It's like you want to be popping up at the top of people's social media feeds and getting traction and engagement. The politicians are essentially kind of at the hands of the social media bosses who are in control, although I use that word control kind of lightly, because I think a lot about algorithmic systems is actually maybe that they're not so in control of them in the end after all. But they have ultimately built these systems that favour or prioritise certain types of content. And so all of politics now is being shaped by like who can perform best in that social media realm. And the people with the keys to like the system are incredibly rich, often not very accountable bosses of companies all over the world who are actually affecting politics. And like, we're talking here quite a lot about politics in the UK and the US, but there's loads of examples like throughout the world of where politicians are having to game the algorithms regardless of where you are, because that is now the interface between you and the public.
And in Europe, Sean pointed to a couple of examples of influencers and YouTubers who are now becoming politicians.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's increasingly important to have a presence on social media. And I think no one does this better than Trump's White House. The White House's TikTok account is absolutely crazy right now. It's like that strategy of putting Get Brexit Done under Boris Johnson's head in Comic Sans, but times a million.
That's like small fry compared to
absolutely.
What we're seeing now.
We've got, you know, they're posting bombs over Iran cut with SpongeBob saying we'll do it again.
You want to see me do it again? You want to see me do it again?
They declared war on Iran basically to Blow by Kesha. She's now kind of complained that they used her music. But they can use it, right? Because it's all cleared by the record label for TikTok. It's actually like free marketing for them. I mean, you have to look at this TikTok account, the White House TikTok account, to understand how crazy it is.
And what's so interesting is, like, when you think of official accounts, like what official accounts used to be like the White House account or like Number 10 in the UK, like the Prime Minister's sort of office's official account, or like any of the kind of departments, like government departments, broadly, and I would say this is still the case for quite a lot of like the government departments in the UK, that they are kind of like quite boring accounts that are, they're seen as kind of like official channels rather than a reflection of the leader in charge. Whereas the White House account like is in Donald Trump's image. Like,
yeah.
And that feels so different now as well. You look at some of the accounts belonging to some of the embassies connected to Russia or to Iran. Like, it's the language of the internet, sure, yeah. But it's just become like next level rage, trolling, absurdity, satire stuff. And AI, loads of AI.
And it's difficult to overstate just how crazy it is that we are now in a timeline where the White House is kind of waging TikTok. This is like the first TikTok war. And the memification of this war, it contributes to this sense that the war isn't real, right? And it, people have been saying that this war feels less real than previous
wars. Or even
that
it's not serious as well.
Yeah, that it's not taken seriously. I mean, people also use the term hyper-reality to refer to the White House memes about this war, because hyper-reality is this idea that like the signs and symbols of something have more kind of weight in how we perceive it than the thing itself. And we're interpreting the bombing of Iran through the memes that the White House is putting out on TikTok. It's all just the White House kicking ass. It's not any like plan for how the war will end. Where will it go? What are the objectives? Not even a nod to like the bloody horrible reality of the war. The fact that hundreds of civilians have died as well as part of, you know, it's just SpongeBob memes. And it basically makes us lose sight of like what is actually happening, which is like one of the largest geopolitical conflicts in the past decade. And of course, people are saying that Starmer's video is like a Temu version, an attempt at doing what the White House is doing now.
I think that actually there's a connection between both of the things that we've been analysing today, because ultimately they are about the way that the business models and designs of the social media companies incentivize certain types of behaviours, whether that's from just an influencer sitting at home or whether that is from like world leaders during like conflict and war. They are ultimately shaping the behaviours because those algorithmic systems are dictating the rules really of who gets to succeed and who doesn't.